So my name is Jocelyn Estes, and I'm Tlingit. My family's from Wrangell. I'm of the Raven Moiety and Kachuti clan, which means frog. And I'm a member of the Alaska Native Media Group, which is putting on this Alaska Native Book Fair.
My name is Willie Hensley, and my traditional name is Evaruk. I'm named for my grandfather, my mother's father. And I'm from Kotzebue. I'm a Kikiktarugmi, as we say, a person from a little island, sort of. Anyway, I'm retired, but I do some teaching at the university. And I'm sort of here to talk about my memoir, I guess.
We'll start with the book fair. How did this come about?
Well, there's a group of us who have worked as reporters and just in communication and in communications, and we see young people not coming into the field, and we want to encourage that, and we want to encourage people to read. So we came up with the idea for, and we wanted to honor Alaska Native authors. So the book fair is Friday, October 12th, from 1 to 7 at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium office building, which is, if you're standing out on Tudor looking at the hospital, it's to your left. It's on the other side of the pond there. It looks like it's on Elmore, but they say they're on Ambassador Drive. And we're going to have three panels with people talking about writing, publishing, and how to write for children. And then we have, I think, 18 authors lined up to come, and they'll be selling their books. And this is going on all day, pretty much, 1 to 7. So people will have a chance to sit and chat with the authors, which I think is very interesting. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, and we've got one of those authors with us.
Actually, this is Willie. I would have really benefited from talking to people like you because I wasn't an author. I still don't think of myself as one, in spite of having published a book. But having gone through the process of writing and publishing is a great experience. And I'm glad that they're offering this to the public because we have a lot of stories to tell. People have a lot of information and a lot of interesting experiences. And we actually, the way I look at it, need to tell our own story. And I have collected books about the Arctic, explorations, missionaries, traders, anthropologists, all my life. And rarely have you come across our own people's work, during the last, during the last, 60 years or so. But looking at the world through the eyes of people who've been here for 10,000 plus years is a different perspective than, somebody who may come, from later.
Yeah.
Later years, yeah.
I think the people who move here, oftentimes what ends up happening is they leave their families, they leave their parents and siblings behind from wherever they came from. And then in my experience, I look at that and think about how I would feel when I went outside for college for a couple of years. I just longed for my family all the time.
Totally. I'm with you there because I left when I just turned 15 for 4 years, for boarding school, thousands of miles away, and there wasn't a day which I didn't think about home, and hungered for the food. And actually, you miss a lot. You just miss a lot, in those years, which is why, I'm very sensitive to this whole issue of boarding schools, mm-hmm. Because it was part of the process that separated our families and separated us from our culture.
Yeah.
And so, it's a different point of view. And when you're looking at history, I've found that because I teach, you get a different perspective completely.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate part of history that it's often written by the conquerors, the colonizers. And so part of the joy for me is being able to talk to people and listen to their stories and talk to them about their stories and listen to their language and get to share that and keep it alive.
And this issue about leaving your family is, it reminds me of something Roger Lang said at Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. And we were talking about the problem of high turnover among teachers in rural Alaska. And he said, one or the other is going to be away from home and be missing it, or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And I think he was absolutely right. And my gosh, that was probably 30 years ago or something. It was quite a while ago. Mm-hmm. And that crisis in rural education is still out there. There's still that high rate of turnover.
Oh, yes. In fact, I was just looking at some photographs that a friend of mine found of our region, taken way back in the 40s and 50s by a school teacher. But unlike others, this school teacher was meticulous about names and dates. I mean, oftentimes if you see pictures that are taken by, you know, a visitor, it always says, you know, so-and-so and a native, right? Or, I mean, and then you never know who is this person.
Or just Eskimo kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this guy, his name was Lindell Bagley. I remember him, actually. I was just a kid. But he taught in Kwikluk, Norvik, Kotzebue. He was also in the military in Nome, and he took phenomenal photos. And they were in color. I mean, here are, there are elders in there that were like young people, you know. And so, to me, it's this kind of material that needs to get into the media, gets into a book, you know, get into a position where our younger people can have access to them and say, well, you know, there's my great-great-grandpa or grandma, you know, or my father or grandfather when he was a young man, you know, and this is the kind of thing. A lot of us, we didn't have cameras.
Oh.
We couldn't afford cameras.
Yeah.
And if you had to have money to ship off the film to get developed, you know, down in Fairbanks or Seattle or Nome, you know. And so a lot of people don't have their own pictures. Like, we barely had any in our family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's maybe three or four pictures of me before the age of 14.
Exactly. Same yeah. problem I had. I mean, I had to scrounge for anything of me, you know, less than 5 years old.
Yeah.
Like a handful.
Oh, even if we're talking less than five, there's one picture of me younger than five. Yeah. Pictures were, I mean, it's funny now because I, like everybody else, I'm taking pictures constantly. And they're just so fun and handy to do. But I remember those days when it was really hard to, well, people just didn't have cameras. And couldn't, yeah. like you said, process the film.
And also it was that, at least in our day, we lived in tents quite often in the summertime because people liked to. And in our case, our sod houses were damp in the summer. So, you know, it took a lot of effort to keep things dry. Also, back then, we traveled by dog team and boat, you know. So trying to keep things, yeah. anything, you know, was a real challenge. In particular, photographs, because they were vulnerable to the weather.
Mm-hmm. 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 So let me get back to the Alaska Native Book Fair that's coming up on Friday, October 12th, at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's office building. And if you folks who are listening have enjoyed listening to Willie Hensley talk, there will be people just like him talking about their life experiences and what it took for them to get it down on paper and get it published. And there, so I think what's really exciting about this is there's a how-to element. So we have three panels, and each of the panels will be talking about something different, but all of it having to do with writing and getting published.
That kind of brings me to a point for Willie. What, you know, what was there something about the process of putting your memoir into a published book? Was there like one thing that stuck out as you to you as being like this huge hurdle, or you didn't know how you were going to do it?
Absolutely, everything, all of the above.
All of it.
Well, first of all, at least in our world up there, up north, if you have any assets in your life, it's not for you to talk about, right? It's a memoir, a little bit smacks of kind of patting yourself on the back. So that was a hurdle for me. I think a big one, but. in the end, when I thought about all the books that had been written by people about us, you know, I thought, you know, we got to tell our own story. And so I took the risk, and my biggest worry was, you know, will people think this is an accurate reflection of life at that time? And is it accurate, you know? And I've been very pleased because I've gotten really positive reactions on the whole, you know, from the book, because I think people saw it as a reflection of their own lives, you know, and because we're all under the same kind of pressures, you know, starting as little kids. And I think in looking back, you know, my publishers would have been happier than hell if I had just stopped at age 15, because, you know, they were interested in that old world, right, what I call the old life. But, you know, all the political stuff we had to go through to try to change the world we're in, the claims battle, even the corporate world that we had to get into, to me it was all part of my life, and it, you know, it needed to be written about. And so, but still I lost about 100 pages on the cutting room floor, uh-huh. Right? Because the editors are that's what they do, right? They make judgments about what they think should be in and what will sell, really. And so that was a challenge. But I enjoyed the process. I discovered that when I was going to write in the morning, I had to have loose clothing on. I would not look at the television. I would not look at the newspaper. I'd just kind of like sit there and look at I could see the flowers and the squirrels and the plants and the birds, and I'd just sit there and try to bring to life these memories and recollections and events and persons, and I learned from my editor to be as descriptive as I could, and also because in my mind things were pretty darn clear, but for the average concrete jungle person, you know, it's a different world, and she wanted to have that flavor, yeah. You know, and so that's what I tried to do.
Did those words come easy for you, or were they hard?
Yeah. I never had writer's block. I did have a tendency to write sentences that were way too long that I learned I needed to kind of shorten up. But the good news was that I had spent 40 years or more working on crossword puzzles.
What?
You know, yeah. I started out doing the simplest ones, and so I was accustomed to, and I love words and meanings, not just in our language, but, you know, English. And so I was always dealing with meanings and shades of meaning.
Oh, those.
And in the end, it really paid off, and it was sort of accidental, but it
helped.
Well,
I just started doing crossword puzzles since I retired a couple of years ago, and it just seems like they pick the most kind of it's puns or double meanings. They're constantly putting in clues that you could, and I'll go down that little path that way for the longest time, putting in the wrong letters. So, did you do the New York Times puzzle?
Actually, I graduated to the New York Times a number of years ago, and when I first started, I mean, I felt good if I got two or three or four.
That's how I.
But there. But now I can do. In fact, that's about the only reason I get the New York Times now is to get that magazine section. You know, the rest of it I hardly even look at. But the New York, I keep them for like I work on them weeks. I have them sitting there.
Oh,
I'll come
good
back
for
because
you.
You know, because you know, you do. Your mind does all of a sudden, you know, click, and all of a sudden you get something, then you get maybe one or two more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how many hours a day did you write?
Well, at that time I was working. I was in D.C., so I could only write at night, on weekends, holidays, and on airplanes, you know. And so I actually had my book done in the first year and a half, but it took four between the contract and the publishing date, you know. And so it took a while, but I had it done pretty much in the first year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. And then just in case anybody thinks they're going to get rich writing books, Can you count what you got from the sales in the hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Actually, I was very, very lucky because I had, I was encouraged by others for one thing, because the first thing was, you have to believe in yourself and your story. And I didn't. I didn't, because I just looked at my life like other people did. Like, well, I have lots of friends who grew up like I did. I mean, and they're out there too. And I didn't think that there was anything special about me. But it took others sort of encouraging me to actually give it a try,
Well, you have led an unusual life. I mean, to go from living in a sod house to walking the halls of Congress, lobbying, and you were in the state legislature, and you've been a leader in the Native corporate world and at AFN. I mean, you've moved a lot, I think.
Well, I've thought about that, and of course I've been asked about it. And, in fact, you just reminded me, there was one head of a corporation a few years ago who called me and left a voicemail for me to call him directly. And he had only one question when I called him, because he had read my memoir. And he said, "Why you, Willie?" And I didn't know what to say, because I don't know. It's just the reality was that I had had these experiences. Out in the country, in this what I call the old world, and live with great people who came from the turn of the century, who in my mind represented like some of the best qualities of our world, and maybe absorb some of what was in them, and sort of had the tools to function in a modern world. That's why I went to Tennessee, to try to learn how to think and read and maybe research eventually. And so I had just happened to pick up the information I needed to try to be of some value. Because, in our world, of course, service is kind of a key value of our people, is trying to help, where you can. And so I was there and thankfully was able to, put my oar in the water along with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know what I'd say if somebody asked me something like that. Why you? I mean, why not me? But I think the reason you were stumped is because of what you said earlier about not being a value to not go on and on about yourself.
Totally.
Like, what are you going to say? Because I'm so important? because well, I'm so remarkable?
And I think part of it is that I think we know from that world up north that we had to rely on other people to make it, right? I mean, it's never you doing anything on your own. It's always people around you who put their shoulder to the wheel, so to speak, to help survive. And that's ingrained in your DNA, so to speak, mm-hmm. after several thousands of years of trying to make a life out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I've read articles about that where they talk about, and the example that I've read about over and over is they'll test Japanese people and then Americans to look at a fish tank and write, draw it or something or describe it. And the Japanese focus on the context. Mm-hmm. And I've read that Alaska Natives think of the community right off the bat. How's this going to help my family? What about my mm-hmm. cousin's ex-husband's niece, mm-hmm. this would be good for her, So.
I think there's something to that. I think mm-hmm. In the physical world, I think that's true too, because, our people had to sort of visualize what it is that they were trying to construct, right? And it had to be very, very efficient. I mean, when you look at those harpoons and those harpoon heads and all the stress that was placed, on that equipment, and it had to work. Otherwise, you're going to lose your next month's meal, mm-hmm. right? And so, really, their technology was just amazing. They understood, you know, the nature of what they were doing, and they had to be able to visualize it.
Huh? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what's next for you? Are you going to write another book?
well, see, that you know, I wished I were a real writer in the sense that, you know, real writers have to write, you know, because otherwise they don't exist. You know, that's what they do. But as you said earlier, that, well, I have done this and I have done that, which is true. I mean, I've done a whole variety of different things. And so to me, writing is sort of one of the things I did and learned to do, but it's not who I am per se. I mean, there are ideas and stuff I've had. In fact, I started trying to write a novel one time, and I'd love to actually complete it, you know. I call this novel, I still have it in my head, it's called a Sivik, the Umelik of Arctica. And I stole the name from Chester Sivik, but I wanted him to be like, I call him the Umelik of Arctica because I was using Umelik. Our word for Umelik is the person who owned the boat, right? And also it became translated as a rich person. But I was using it as the Umelik, like the president of a country called Arctica. And it was about this little individual who was a baby, who was the only survivor of an attack on this family. And he was found by an older couple under a alder bush in his caribou skin sleeping bag. And they raised him to be their own, and they raised him to be a leader, but he was also a nangatkuk. You know, he was a shaman. And that combination of powers allowed him to become the leader of this massive space, you know, that went eventually all the way from Moscow to Greenland, right? And that was my idea for
a
novel
idea.
In which you can put in a lot of different things, you know.
Yeah.
And so maybe before I croak, maybe maybe I'll do that.
Well, see, that's the other thing that people don't really know about. I don't think people know as much as they might about the international aspect of mm-hmm. the Inuit. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed Daly Sambo, mm-hmm. who's the director of the Inuit Circumpolar Council here in mm-hmm. for Alaska, mm-hmm. and the chairmanship shifts from between Greenland and where else, Alaska and Canada, and now it's right here in Alaska, yeah. And the stuff that they take on is phenomenal.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize, in fact, our own people have not been able to visualize the fact that the Inupiat culture, you know, comprises the Sukpiak, you know, which is the Kodiak people, and linguistically very closely connected. But
now, wait, what'd you just say?
The Sukpiak,
yeah. And where are they?
Kodiak, and
you're
and,
kidding. Yeah, I thought they were Yupik.
Oh no.
I remember when it was such a revelation, and yeah. We were kind of resisting when anthropologists said they're yeah. You know,
they're Sukpiak. They're not Undangan, right, which is the Aleutian Islanders, but even the Aleutian Island is connected to the Inuit world. But the Inuit world actually goes from the Pacific to the Atlantic, starting out right there where Shelikov bombarded to take control back in 1784. But if you say certain words, and I like to use the word Kiktak. Kiktak or Kiktak is an island. And actually, Shelikov wrote about fighting with the people of Kiktak, you know. And so if you use that word all up and down the west coast of Alaska, even up north to the Mackenzie Delta, to Hudson's Bay, to parts of Quebec, parts of Labrador, and to Greenland, they'll know what you're talking about. And so that's a concept that our own people even have not really thought of that much. But, that culture spread, you know, from the Pacific all the way to the Atlantic. And I like to tell people that if we had 200 more years, we could have founded Europe.
Flag.
Yeah.
Jacqueline, you want to wrap up and remind us about the book fair?
Yes. It's open to the public and children are welcome. Best Beginnings is going to have a table there where kids can sit and color and write and create their own books. We'll have panels starting at 4, from 4 to 4:45, then every hour basically at 4, 5, and 6. And during the day people can get together, buy books, talk to authors, that sort of thing. So I hope we get a great turnout. I mean, I'm really interested in seeing. I haven't seen all the books that'll be there at the Alaska Native Book Fair. So just to make sure people, if you didn't catch it earlier, this is happening Friday, October 12th from 1 to 7 p.m. at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium office building. And if you're going to input the address into your phone, it's 4000 Ambassador Drive.
Maybe I should read who's going to be there.
Oh, well, sure.
Is that okay? The participating Native authors are Phyllis Adams. She wrote The Gingerbread Moose, Alaska Boots for Chelsea. There's the Atwaters, who wrote Walter's Story, How the Raven Got Its Crooked Beak. And there's Brittany Brower, who wrote Weaving Our Worlds. She's in Inupiaq. Phyllis Fast, she's got several books. Half Bead of Fundy, Midnight Drama, The Girl Who Helped the Deer, Umbrella and Her Umbrella. And then Jan Haynes Harper, Cold River Spirits. Dolly Hills, A Mother's Tears for a Missing Son. And we have me, 50 Miles from Tomorrow, Sharon Kay and Paula. Sharon Kay, Learn to Weave an Attu Basket. Chris Kayana, he's done several. Alaska Crying Baby, Wally the Lost Baby Walrus, 100 Alaska Eskimo Yo-Yo Stratagems. Did you know there were 100? I didn't. David Light, Brothers in Harmony. Larry McCreliff, Wisdom Keeper, One Man's Journey to Honor the Onungan People. Loretta Outwater, Winter Walk, Josie Nungatuk, Give or Take a Century, and that was written a long time ago. I know Joe. Beverly Sims, Our Fur Fathers of Southwest Alaska. Vera Starboard, Our Voices Will Be Heard. Raina Thiel, who will be speaking, and she's written a book called West Wingers about her experience in Washington, D.C. And then you have Sea Alaska Heritage, who has a book called Baby Raven Reads. So those are, and there's illustrators as well. Danielle Larson, Martin Zach.
Zach Martin.
Mm-hmm. And I think, is that it?
Yeah, and then there's publishers. Yeah. So we have, I can go up to that list. Let's see. Representatives from Epicenter Press. That's Lori Evans Deneen. Lois Swenson from, she's a publications consultant. And then Flip Todd with Todd Communications and Lisa Alexia with Denali Sunrise Publications. So I mean, I look at, you know, I've seen this list, but hearing you read it, I thought of how much I loved some of these books. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Some of the books I didn't realize the author had written more than one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really excited about looking at these books and getting to know some of the authors. I hope we have a lot of people show up.
Yeah, I do too. Hopefully I'll get my copy of 50 Miles from Tomorrow signed.
There you go.
Is there anything that you want to add before we wrap up?
Well, just to say that I had the good fortune of having my book published in a foreign language.
Oh, my gosh.
In Korean.
Wow.
Isn't that something?
Yes.
I mean, it was just, I have no idea what happened, but somebody's found it, and it was a new publishing house, and he liked it, so they put it in their language. So I met a Chinese vice governor of Heilongjiang here at dinner one time about 2 months ago. And she said she had 38 million people in her province.
Oh my gosh.
And I said, you know, if you published my book over there, and if only 1% of the people bought it, I'd be rich.
That, I think a lot of people would be interested. It's a rare story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know any other book that has the breadth. So, congratulations on that. Kudos to you for doing that.
Liana.
And
well, thank you so much for both of you for coming in.
Well, thank you, Trip.
Gunashis Kanyana.
Yeah.
It was a real pleasure.